In 2008, Professor Kerim Hussein joined Hobart and William Smith Colleges as a professor in the education department. As a professor, Hussein has taught courses focusing on race and culture within education and writes that his goal as an educator is to reinscribe public education as a site for culturally responsive and community-oriented democratic learning. This experience positions Hussein in a unique spot as a new interim dean of Hobart College. With renewed talk of traditions and diversity in the student body, we must ask what it means to be a Hobart statesman today. Hello, and thank you for tuning in to the Seneca Scene, a podcast from The Herald, the campus newspaper of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Each week, we bring you the latest campus news and an extended interview with a member of the campus community, either faculty, staff, or student. This is the second in our three-part series to start the year exploring the state of the colleges. Interim President McGuire was our first guest in the series. Next week, we will sit down with William Smith Dean Lisa Kenzik, and today, we welcome Interim Hobart Dean Kerim Hussein. I'm Albright Dworka, and this is the Seneca Scene from The Herald. On the show today, Interim Hobart Dean Kerim Hussein. Prior to joining the colleges, he was a social studies teacher in New York City and had taught at Syracuse University, as well as at the International Islamic Institute in Islamabad, Pakistan. His expertise focused primarily on education with experience in race studies, which situated him in a unique position to steward Hobart College through this period of transition. He brings two decades of experience working with students and has made a concerted effort to involve students in decisions affecting Hobart. In the summer of 2018, following the retirement of Eugen Baer, he was named Interim Hobart Dean. Dean Hussein, welcome to the Seneca Scene, and thank you for being on the show. How are you doing today?
All right, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, so today we're just going to talk about some things about Hobart Colleges. You're new as Interim Dean, and we're just going to have a conversation about what's going on, some of the issues, and some of the things that you want to do. I wanted to start off with traditions. At the matriculation ceremony, you mentioned the paddle, and your speech was about the paddle and about the story and tradition behind the paddle, and having conversation about if we want that story to continue or if we want to modify it. So, Agayentes paddle, can you talk a little bit about that and about your view on it and how it relates to Hobart traditions?
Certainly. I think of the writer Thomas King, who says that stories are wondrous things and they are dangerous. To me, the story itself, the making of the story is a wondrous thing. It comes out of a 19th century Hobart student narrative about the discovery of a paddle and a variety of different contexts, some that it was discovered in the lake and some that it came from a Seneca warrior, and then receives this name, Agayanta. What I think is significant about the creative process is that students have the capacity to imagine how they fit into the stories of a people in a land where their institution sits. What I think is challenging is what do we do with storytelling today when, we have one of our most remarkable scholars on campus, Jeff Anderson, who just shared with faculty and staff the story of the forced removal of the Seneca people by Sullivan in the late 18th century. And, that was the foreground for a lot of what Geneva becomes. What do we do and what is our responsibility to that past? What is our responsibility to ourselves in terms of the kinds of stories we want to tell? Because, certainly I could sit here and go on and on about what I think would be an important or significant symbol. But what I think is more interesting to me and more important in terms of my role is to invite students in to have a conversation about the symbols and rituals that we want to have as part of our identity, right? What do you want to see in the symbols and rituals that we have? Because there is something very powerful about the time and history that we have before us, and connecting to other students for centuries is exciting. But the terms around which we do it, we can make choices about. And so in part, what I'm hoping to communicate to all Hobart students is that I am here to give you permission from where I'm empowered to tell your story, to take these symbols and make them meaningful in ways that are true to you. So I'm going to be inviting students to come to the table and to dialogue. I'll have a couple opportunities to do that throughout the semester and a few throughout the year to do open dialogues about traditions and rituals, and also creating a committee of students that will get together to advise on community in particular and these traditions and the ones that really resonate with us. Because at the end of the day, you're also establishing a legacy of your own, right? And if you want to connect that to the First Nation people that were here, there's a lot of authentic and meaningful ways, right? There's lacrosse games that go back to, you know, the early 20th century, 1906, 1907, that you can connect to. You have Abraham Lafort, the Haudenosaunee student who studied at the medical college in 1828. There's a variety of ways where we can connect to that past. And there's also examples from our counterparts. Colgate University, for instance, has a First Nation ceremony as part, along with bagpipes, along with their ceremony. So how do we honor and recognize within our practices, within our curriculum, within our traditions, which is what I think the intention was. Right, I think the intention was a good one, but how can we do that in a way that isn't appropriating or reimagining things, which were a byproduct of a different culture and a different time? We could do all sorts of things now, right, that are meaningful and true to us and that speak to our ethic, our value, while not flinching from the truth of our past, right, because we are scholars here. And that is one of the most exciting things about what you're going to be capable of doing is being thoughtful and honest and creative and imaginative simultaneously. And we'll bring alums in. We'll make this something that's yours. So I want to invite everyone who is interested, open, committed, curious to doing that kind of creative work to sit at the table. And you'll be getting those invitations throughout the semester. Take me up on it. And see if I'm really serious. Let's find out.
So one of the reasons why students like this story and they buy into it is because they get a paddle. They get something physical that they get to keep as part of colleges. So if the traditions are changed, would you give something else to students? Or would you stop giving out the paddle? What would happen in those terms?
And that's where this is exactly the conversation that I want to expand, right? Is do we keep the paddle? Do we rename the paddle? Do we do nothing? Right? Let's find out what really matters to us as a community of scholars and students. And let's do that, right? Because there's something profound about a paddle. I think it's a powerful symbol of agency and efficacy and choice and decision making. And that's exactly what college is supposed to be about. So it's a fantastic symbol, right? But what do we do with it? The stories we tell about the things we have are as important as the things we have.
It's a great line. I want to move on from traditions to the bicentennial celebration. What are your plans for the bicentennial celebration?
So in part, I think that the bicentennial needs to be a celebration of the movement through time, the stories through time. And so I would like to see the Hobart Dean's Office articulate visually timelines of students, generations of students, so that we can see visibly photographs, portraits, artifacts that our fellow Hobart students, your fellow Hobart students, have embodied and held on to over the ages. I think that's going to be an important part of it. And also these particular dialogues, not just about the matriculation ceremony, but about all of our rituals and traditions. I think I want to really get us to explore those so that whatever you all decide you want to do with them, you do it with a sense of awareness and ownership, right? And there's a great excuse. Having the bicentennial really gives us the opportunity to reflect on what is it, whether it's the story of John Henry Hobart, or if it's the ways in which some of the artifacts over time that we have identified are still meaningful, can become meaningful for students. And that can be through research, public presentation, archival work, collaborating with library archives, working with alums, right? Public storytellings. And like I said, these dialogues about heritage and tradition.
All right, thank you. That sounds great and definitely fits into traditions and going over all of that in the bicentennial celebration. I want to move on to diversity. Diversity is a big issue on campus, and you as a person of color, I want to talk about your experience in diversity on this campus and before at other colleges that you have been a part of.
So I think one of the biggest paradoxes of working in higher education is that these are institutions that were simply not built for everyone. And now they invite everyone. That is what we're trying to make sense of. And to do that, I think we have to be intentional. Because if you continue to follow a sense of status quo around the ways in which institutions operate, then you're still reinforcing the particular culture, the particular class, and the particular interests that a lot of these institutions were originally founded upon, where that's not what we're reporting anymore. When we say that we want to promote a culture of respect, when we say we want to cultivate inclusive excellence, what does that mean? In part, it means that everyone has a seat at the table, that everyone can participate, that when we look around campus and we look at the kinds of communities we have, that a student can look upon any one of those, right, and see themselves there, right? And so that's, I think, in part what diversity work means, is that everyone gets to participate. For me as a person of color, what I think matters is that I have, in my own lived experience, a version of higher education that is I think, steeped in stories that have been meaningful and important to me. And I want to be able to impart both the universal and the particular from those stories. So as a first-generation student from a working-class background, what it meant to have resilience as a driving feature to navigate and make sense of life on a college campus, the ways in which advocates and supports were so critical to that work became really, you know, important. And if you were listening during the matriculation ceremony, that was how I used the oar. I gave the example of my oar, which was a dictionary that I beat up because I looked up every other word that I didn't know. And there were a lot. So that is, I think, in part what each of us in positions of leadership have to offer is, again, our stories and our ability to make meaning out of those stories in order to lead, right?
As a dean, how are you going to, let's restart that. As a dean, how do you address religious diversity on campus?
I think that what we have is a unique kind of student-centeredness, right? And I think that that's where we need to cultivate a recognition both of religious diversity and those that are not religious. I remember when I was applying to schools as a high school student, and I went into a student union, and I ran into a professor, and I asked the professor if there was a Muslim student union. And he said, no. And I expect you to create one. And that, to me, is what a student-centered approach to religious diversity is about. It's about empowering students with the resources and information so that they can organize themselves into communities that are meaningful and reflective, sometimes in particular, but still signaling to a universal that we all get to participate in that kind of diversity, in that kind of sacredness, however we discover that and however we explore it. And this is, I think, a really important entry, which is, you know, I said earlier that the dean's office wants to invite students into a conversation about our traditions. I also want to invite students, William Smith, Hobart students, to attend when they're invited into other people's cultures and other people's practices. When you receive that invitation, right, arrive at the door, right? You have an opportunity that's unlike any other opportunity you'll have. You will meet people here that are different than, and in a different context than virtually any other time in your life. And so when we talk about religious diversity, I think it's only as profound as religious curiosity or openness about belief systems more widely than even religion.
you've already done some of that work of having those conversations. A lot of those, a space for those conversations that you've helped create is Mocha. Some people may not know what Mocha is. Can you speak a little bit about it?
Certainly. The Millennials of Color Assembly was something that emerged out of some research that two students were doing, Brandy Taylor and Danslier Johnson, for a SILS Foundation grant. And they sought to understand the kinds of racial divisions that exist in Geneva and beyond. And what that led them to ultimately was a conclusion that there need to be opportunities for engagement between students of color in higher education and students of color in the Geneva community at large. And so they really took that on as their charge and expanded it. My work, again, I hope, as I think in my best moments, is going to be about creating supportive contexts for students to do empowering and meaningful work, as opposed to being the driver or having my agenda somehow fulfilled. I think that that's where really profound and transformative education and learning comes from. And so for me, I really saw myself in an advisory role or supportive role, and the students were the ones leading that. And so they've done a series of workshops that have connected students at Geneva High School, at Newark High School, and of course Hobart and William Smith. So what I think is really significant for me as a takeaway is that our students are capable of educating each other collectively, that their experiences are a kind of knowledge, and they're a kind of text, at least in their storytelling, that's really important to learn from and to teach with. And so what I would like to see moving forward is more opportunities for our students to be able to do peer-to-peer work, to do transformational work across generations, as much as high school and college are different generations, but at least across some degree of age difference. And for us as professors, instructors, administrators, to be there to really provide supportive context, reflective feedback, and to give them the tools so that they can engage in peer-to-peer teaching.
You were also part of the Tools for Social Change group. Can you speak a little bit on that?
Tools for Social Change originated as a service learning initiative between Hobart and William Smith students and the long-term residents of the Geneva community. And we started a few years ago really with the aim of creating a space for dialogue across differences of race and place, and then to see where that led. And where it led was really profound. I don't think anyone who was a part of that original group could have imagined what was possible when you put a 98-year-old and an 18-year-old and an 8-year-old, right, in the same space where they're having dialogue and they're having dinner and they're trying to understand what community means, what belonging means, and also the places and spaces where they feel isolation. And what we discovered was that if we're going to be a community, a truly bound together community, then the voices from different social positions, different ages, different backgrounds need to be brought to the table in a meaningful way, not only so that stories can be heard, but then we can enact certain practices together. And so a lot of the people that started with Tools those years ago worked together to do work around food insecurity, to do work on economic opportunity, to do work that was specific to political agency and enfranchisement and registration. And so we saw real things happening in this community, and it's a small enough city that if you apply enough focus over time, you will see change quickly. And so one of the most powerful things that came out of Tools for Social Change was the ways in which our Hobart and William Smith students were transformed as people and the choices they made after graduation about the kind, many of them stayed in the community or went into work that they wouldn't have thought of doing otherwise because they had built relationships with people that they don't naturally encounter. right? There are people that we will pass by in Wegmans and on the street that we won't look at twice, that may be the most important people that we were ever supposed to meet. We're supposed to create a context for that, I think. That's what service learning at its best is capable of doing, is creating a context for that encounter. And I think that we have done a lot of groundwork as an institution to allow for that. And there's a long history of a relationship between the overall city of Geneva and the particular campus of Hobart William Smith for that to happen. And so if anything, I would love to see initiatives like Tools for Social Change really taken on by students, by professors, by administrators on campus, and by long-term community residents as well.
Those are some great impacts that you've had in those groups, and I hope that more students join those groups and join the conversation. You mentioned transforming students. I want to look at this from the other side. Hobart College is supposed to transform students into Hobart statesmen. The idea of a statesman has been mentioned at my matriculation ceremony with Dean Eugen Baer. However, there's been a lot of issues surrounding this. For example, the issue of toxic masculinity on campus has been huge. Can you speak a little bit about that and how the deans are addressing this?
Has anyone ever asked you to be a man or act like a man?
Yes.
I don't know if you remember the first time you heard that or an early age when you heard that. But for anyone who's ever had that asked of them, I want you to just take a moment right now and think about what was happening in your life when someone told you to be a man or to act like a man. Was it something that was being taken away from you? Was there a way that you were being that you were told you are no longer allowed to be that way? Were you vulnerable? Were you afraid? Were you expressing emotions? Right? What was going on in your life when you were told to be a man? I think embedded in that question is one of the challenges that we all have to face. And that is that these narrowly defined and often defined for us descriptions and parameters of what it means to be a man are keeping us not only from treating others well, but treating ourselves well. And if we grew up in a box called the man box, right? What chance does the rest of the world have of getting to know us? And what chance do we have to actually be authentic people in the world? And this is where I think some of the struggle is coming from with this idea of being a man and then that narrative being associated with being a statesman. So I think one of the things we have to do is exactly what you just did, is ask, what is toxic masculinity and where is it playing out in our community? I think we have to be forward-leaning on this because it's hard. But this is what grown-ups do, right? They walk towards the difficult things, right? And if we want to take the best possibilities of what it is to be a statesman, right? If you want to take that symbol, what is a statesman? In my mind, and I believe in the dean's office, a statesman is someone who is prepared to take responsibility for themselves and for their community, right? I'm reminded of the poet William Ernest Henley, who famously penned, "I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul." That, right? How do we get to that? Now that's exciting to me, right? And that I think is a way for us to honor the highest possibilities of a symbol that represents responsibility for self, responsibility for others. And so I want us to be prepared to earn our own respect, right? What have you done today to earn your own respect so that you can respect yourself, right? And then what have you done to earn the respect of others, right? What have you done to care for yourself? And what have you done to care for others? And so can you see how these two things are tied, right? You can't be in a state where you have this fixed notion of manliness and still be taking care of yourself or care for others, right? Because you've already boxed yourself out. So you're going to have to be a little bit more fluid. I'm going to have to be a little bit more fluid. We're going to have to be prepared to learn. And that's going to require humility, right? And we're all figuring this out. Let me say that. No one has this figured out. We are in an age of transition, right? We're in a moment where gender identity and gender formation have become a more foregrounded aspect of public discourse, public meaning, and public policy, right? And so it's going to continue to be complex terrain. It's probably not going to be a flat ride through Kansas, right? It's going to require us to be attentive and to be prepared to hear other people's stories and other people's experiences, because the greatest challenge for me as a cisgendered straight man is really hearing stories that aren't mine and finding a way to honor those stories, right? Because every student here, and this is an absolute commission for the dean's office, is worthy of the dignity, right, that they were born with. And so we have to recognize, honor, and protect the dignity of all people that are on this campus. I mean, that's the same issue with whether it's the or whether it's talking about LGBTQ issues or toxic masculinity, right? That's what it fundamentally comes down to. And so I am, again, going to be a broken record here, calling upon Hobart students to enter this conversation with me. You have a seat at the table. What does it look like for us to create statesmen that honor the dignity of all people? What does it look like for us to create a context and an environment where that symbol signals to everyone that we are taking responsibility for ourselves, we are taking care of ourselves, we are taking responsibility for others, and we are taking care of others?
The statesman is a wonderful idea and an ideal that all Hobart students should shoot to become, like you said, and I'm glad you opened up the conversation and have an actual action plan instead of just saying all of these profound things and not actually doing anything about it, which I think students would like and are going to relate to. On the other end of the spectrum of a statesman is a hobro. Have you heard this term before?
I have.
Now, how do we change the idea of a hobro?
I think that the hobro term probably came out of, Hobart students probably came up with that name, I suspect, right? And again, here I go. It's going to be Hobart students, right? So I'm looking forward to, in a few weeks, being a part of an emerging leader session for Greek life. And one of my goals in that workshop is to redirect any energy that might be coming my way right back at you, right? What do we need to be doing as peer leaders, right? So where do we see, like, hobro, what does that mean, first of all, right? Let's really unpack that. Let's be honest. Let's create a space where we can have honest conversations, right? And then let's talk about who's struggling with that, right? Who is that painful for? What might be better than that particular way of participating in campus life and off-campus life? And that's where the peer-to-peer work is going to matter, because a lot of times we are silent when we are uncomfortable and we don't want to come across as uncool. We don't want to come across as using a term like uncool. And I'm old, remember. But we want to come to those situations knowing that we have more than our own minds to bear on that. We're not alone. If you're feeling really uncomfortable, other people probably are too. And also probably the person that's making you uncomfortable is uncomfortable on some level, right? But nobody's talking about that part of it, right? So we've just got to get to the honest part of this, right? Peel back the performance of it and get to, why are we participating in campus life this way, and what is it doing for others when we do, right? And this isn't about, you know, policing. This isn't about categorically kind of segregating one particular group. It's the exact opposite, right? It's about trying to create a community, right? And I think through peer-to-peer work, we're probably more likely to have that transformation happen than virtually any other way. So again, our work, our role is to create the context, to empower the space, and then let you all make the transformation.
The silence of bystanders is a huge obstacle that we definitely need to address, especially in terms of rape culture on campus. Have you encountered this, and do you have any plans to address this?
I would go back at least to the first part of my last answer and to say that from those initial conversations, I think we'll be better informed on how we want to step forward. We've seen in the last few years efforts by the campus, whether it's some of the powerful public performances that Mosaic has conducted, some of the efforts of the Title IX office, and other offices and students on campus that have tried to push this issue. So if nothing else, we need to be a part of the pre-existing movement. And what we also need to do is, I think, from the unique perch that we sit on in the Hobart Dean's office, is to be able to host some of that work from our office. And I think the best way to do that is to just start it. Start the conversation, see what emerges as the most meaningful or most challenging roadblocks, and then move again from a student-centered approach to addressing those. So I'll actually be more interested in flipping the conversation and asking you what needs to be done, right? And asking Hobart and William Smith students, what is it that is going to most effectively impact your sense of safety, your sense of belonging, your sense of free movement on campus and off campus, right? There's where I think the real power is, once again, is to turn this on students and have them push for the kind of community they can live in and thrive in.
Another one of the huge issues on campus that came up during the coordinate talks was the place of trans and gender non-conforming, non-binary students on campus. Where do you see their place on campus, and where do you see that conversation going?
I would repeat, but I don't want to sound like a broken record too much today, but every student on this campus, it is our commission to honor and protect your dignity, to honor and protect your lived experience, and to advocate for places and spaces where you feel a sense of belonging, where you can not only survive, but also thrive. And so in as much as we can be actively engaged in creating those contexts and supporting those policies, we're going to do so. But I think that what's more important there, again, is, you know, are we reaching out? Are we working actively with students? And so one of the initial dialogues that we're going to be having is both dean's offices are going to be dialoguing with the LGBTQ Center, just to really first and foremost get a sense of where the issues are, so that we're not, you know, presuming what the issues are, and then to do our work from there. Because, you know, end to end, we are here to support student development. But we can't do that as well if students don't feel safe, if they don't feel a sense of belonging.
Students definitely do need to feel comfortable and like they belong and have their dignity respected in order to do their best on this campus. And one of the places where that comes from for a lot of people are the values of the campus. Having been a faculty member and now a dean, what do you see as the values of Hobart William Smith Colleges?
For me, everything goes back to students. And in particular, I'm reminded of W.E.B. Du Bois's definition of education, and that is to draw out human power. That, I think, is our commission. That, I think, is our role, is to support student development, right? What do I mean by student development, right? Academic development, social development, identity development, right? Ethical development. Right. All of the elements of growth into a person that, again, can take full responsibility for themselves, right, and can be fully activated as someone who can take responsibility for their community, starts with development, starts with growth, right? I mean, for me, college was one of the most important places for me to really come alive in a whole new way. Right. And to discover things about myself that I didn't realize, and the way that I related to the world, right, to people, to ideas, to places, to time and history. Right. That's what college did for me. And in part, I'm paying that forward. But in part, I think I am affirming one of the most fundamental principles of an institution of higher education. And that is to support student development. And so for me, I want every conversation that I have on this campus to be bookended by one question: what is this doing for student development? Right? And I want to be able to ask that of every colleague and every student even, right, at every turn.
Coming into this new role, having been a professor at the colleges, what did you see as the biggest opportunities for change beyond the students?
I think one of the greatest opportunities for the institution as a whole is to begin to see that we are all part of a community of practice and to create more natural and fluid interactions between different offices and different positions. Everyone here is here towards a common purpose, whether it's buildings and grounds, housekeeping, food services, dining services, the dean's offices, the registrar, the faculty, right? Every office is here and organized together. And so the people that occupy those offices, whatever their institutional status might presume, right? Whether I'm an administrative associate, or whether I'm an IT staff member, or whether I'm a tenured faculty member, or an untenured faculty member, or a tenured dean, or an untenured dean, that I am here as a part of that community. And we need to start, I think, really maximizing the power of what that can do at a small institution. So to me, the opportunity is to be as connective and connected to my colleagues and my professional collaborators as possible, so that we get a sense of what our respective visions are and what our respective mandates are within that larger mission and vision that we all share. So I think it helps to just get out of your office and just meet with people, sit with people, walk with people, talk with people, and get a sense of what their purposefulness is, because everyone here has that. Everyone here has a sense of purpose. And we don't always see that because we're all so busy taking care of the students, and that's really important. And that's what we're here for. But we should also be just acknowledging, recognizing, and communicating with each other. So dialogue between all of the respective professionals and staff that are here, I think, is absolutely critical.
I love the energy that you have and how active the dean's office is being. If you're asked to continue as a permanent dean, would you take that up?
I am honored to serve for the time that I'm there. I am seeing this time as a time of stewardship. And what I hope that this year will offer is whoever is in that office will be delighted and excited. And then we'll see.
What are your goals as the interim dean, and what do you hope to accomplish during this time?
So my goals, first and foremost, is to seat and thread student development in every feature and facet of our work, to be more connected and connective across campus with my colleagues in different offices, to create a deeper and more fluid delivery of communication between different student groups and the dean's office, because we are the voice of the students. We are advocates of the students. I think more than anyone else, I know this is on record now, so I guess I might be getting myself in trouble here, but I think more than anyone else, it's the dean's office that is here to give voice and advocacy to our students, right? And to do so in a way that is fundamentally about student development. So that, I think, needs to be a clear, strong relationship, which is why I keep emphasizing the importance of dialogue with the deans, and we'll be inviting students to participate in dialogues throughout the semester, as well as shared programming, because we can only be as authentic and an effective voice as we are listening to the voices of students and really understanding and acknowledging them.
Do you have any advice for the new first-year students?
Talk to faculty, develop a relationship with a faculty person. The difference between a student that has at least one faculty person in their life that's really aware of them, knows their name, knows their interests, knows their background, and one that doesn't is night and day sometimes. It's an extraordinary and vast difference. You will find other peers, other mentors, other supports within staff as well. Seek those out too. And faculty, right? Whether it's your advisor, one of your professors right now, build that relationship, and often it will have to be you knocking on their door.
What do you hope your legacy will be at HWS?
I hope people smile when they say my name. and then I'll let that smile speak for itself.
Thank you to Interim Hobart Dean Kerim Hussein for being with us here today. For more information on what we discussed, you can check out the Herald in print or online at hwsherald.com, where we will be discussing more on the state of the colleges following the conclusion of our three-part series. Don't forget to tune in next week for the conclusion of our State of the Colleges series, when we welcome William Smith Dean Lisa Kensick to the show. She will continue our discussion on the state of the colleges, along with an interesting discussion on William Smith College as it moves into its 110th year. Thank you for tuning in, and you can subscribe to us on iTunes or on the Herald website by going to hwsherald.com/podcast. Our show today was written by Alex Karai. It was produced by Albright Dworka and Alex Karai. Our team at the Herald also includes Abby Frederick and Grace Rubel. Our partners at WEOS is Kelly Walker. If you're interested in joining the Herald or the Seneca Scene team, send an email to herald@hws.edu. We have recorded this episode live in the studio at Scanlon Campus Center. From the campus of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, this has been the Seneca Scene. I'm Albright Dworka, and thank you for listening, and we hope you will join us next time.